From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. When Jimi Hendrix went to London in 1966, within a matter of weeks, he was dazzling the reigning rock elite with advanced guitar technique and a bravado stage presence. The reigning British guitar hero at that time was Eric Clapton, but when he shared a stage with Hendrix, Clapton simply stopped playing and walked off, stunned by what he saw. Backstage, Clapton said, "Is he that good?" He'd heard about 10 bars of Jimi Hendrix performing. From 1966 until his death in 1970, Jimi Hendrix redefined guitar playing and studio production and became one of the biggest stars in rock. His influence lives on in the music and in, of course, Seattle's Experience Music Project, originally created to honor the hometown hero. It may have appeared that Jimi Hendrix sprang forth in London fully formed, but that 1966 entry into the rock pantheon was preceded by years of hard slogging as a backup guitarist on the Chitlin circuit with a host of R&B bands including Little Richard, the Isley Brothers, and Don Covey. Stephen Roby is the co-author of a new book documenting those years. It's called Becoming Jimi Hendrix, and Stephen joins us today from San Francisco. Thanks for taking the time.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show.
What struck me from reading the book was that contrast between the hero's welcome Jimi Hendrix got when he went to London and the way he annoyed so many people that he played with in his early years. Why did that happen?
Well, they didn't understand how a African-American rock who wanted to play rock and roll guitar player, rock and roll music, was doing these amazing stunts. I mean, music hadn't shifted until about 1965, 1966, and until Hendrix got down to Greenwich Village, where a black guitar player who did all these crazy antics was more accepted.
You know, you write about how Jimi Hendrix had a kind of a traumatic experience playing one time, and at that point he decided he was never not going to be loud enough. And one of the complaints that he got from some musicians back at the time is that he played too loud. What happened, and how did he adjust to that?
Well, it goes back to 1962. Jimmy had just gotten out of the 101st Airborne Division, the U.S. Army, and made his way down to Nashville, Tennessee. He was trying to make a name for himself. A lot of the antics that we talked about of playing the guitar behind his back, between his legs, biting it with his teeth, other guitarists were doing that. It was kind of the norm then. It seemed unusual when we first saw him on American shores play the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967. But back then in 1962, people like T-Bone Walker were doing that. There's a great story in Becoming Jimi Hendrix where Jimmy tries to take on a local hero, guitar hero, Johnny Jones, at a small Tennessee nightclub. And Johnny Jones had some experience, had a great guitar, a big amp. Jimmy had to wheel his tiny little amp into this this club and do a guitar showdown. But at the end of the night, Johnny Jones, the famed guitar hero, won the battle, and Jimmy kind of put his tail between his legs and walked out of the club there, but vowed never again to be to lose a guitar battle. And since then, when he became famous, his guitar amps were huge and the sound was just enormous.
If you were on tour in the Little Richard band, I guess Jimi Hendrix was not the guy you wanted to be sharing a room with.
Yeah, that's true. Jimmy dressed quite wild back then, had some great run-ins with Little Richard over his hairstyle, which Jimmy was trying to copy the Beatle haircut, then wore Beatle boots and a wild gold chain for a belt, and did some wild guitar solos and took the spotlight away from Little Richard. And as we all know, Little Richard...
You do not do that.
You do not take that away. Finally, Little Richard had to see... He thought all the young girls in the audience were clapping for him and yelling for him, but they looked over, and the spotlight was on his guitar player, Jimi Hendrix. It got quite upsetting to Little Richard to the point where he had to fine Jimmy for breaking the strict band dress code of just a plain white shirt and black tie. And Jimmy was wearing ruffled shirts and different colored shirts. And eventually Jimmy got fired and left Little Richard's band.
Some great stories, too, about how Jimi Hendrix just kept – would he play all the time? He would play guitar late into the night, and his roommates would just get really tired of that. How did this guy, Jimi Hendrix, who got fired so often, always end up getting hired back?
If it wasn't for the great women in his life, especially in these early years, that took him under their wings and cared for him. When Jimmy arrived in New York City, coming from Nashville, Tennessee, in late 1963, he crossed paths with a lady that really took care of him, got him some gigs with the Isley Brothers and other bands when nobody would really talk to him. Jimmy, when he arrived in New York, his ears were filled with the promises of becoming a star overnight. What he didn't realize is this promoter that took him from Nashville to New York was gay, was a female impersonator, and had other designs on Jimmy. But Jimmy hooked up with Lithophane Pridgen, a girl that knew Sam Cooke, had some great connections, and got his career going from there.
Not many of the songs that Jimi Hendrix played on in those early days went very far in the charts. There's one exception, though. It was a hit for Don Covey, covered by many other musicians after that. Listen here for Jimmy's light but funky touch on the rhythm guitar that kicks off this tune. Steve Roby, you're right that tasty guitar part really impressed one of the great American guitarists who worked with the Stax record label.
Steve Cropper, yeah. It was 1965. Jimmy was on tour. 1964. Jimmy was on tour with the great Sam Cooke and Jackie Wilson. The tour had kind of detoured and made its way down to Memphis, Tennessee, where Stax Record is located. And Jimmy had... I heard some rumors that you could just walk into Stax recording studio, tell them you're a guitar player, and they would hook you up with a session, you know, no problem, everything like that. But the date Jimmy walked in, there was hardly anybody around, just a receptionist at the desk, and Steve Cropper was back in the recording studio mixing and producing a track that hadn't been finished yet. But Jimmy, God bless him, he just didn't give up. His persistence was amazing. A secretary out in the lobby kind of shooed him away and just said, well, you know, Steve's kind of busy today. And Jimmy didn't give up. He says, well, I'll be across the street waiting at this snack bar. And sure enough, Steve finally took a break and met Jimmy. Steve brought him back into the recording session, and they traded licks. And Jimmy revealed that he played guitar on the Don Covey track Mercy Mercy, which actually the Rolling Stones covered later. And so they traded licks back and forth. Unfortunately, there was not a tape deck going at the time. Otherwise, we would have had a great duo between Steve Cropper and Jimi Hendrix.
Well, Jimi Hendrix actively sought out other stellar guitarists during his apprenticeship days, didn't he?
In fact, one of them was Curtis Mayfield. A funny story in becoming Jimi Hendrix. In 1963, Jimmy was with this little unknown band that toured the South called the Bonnevilles. And one of the great gigs that the Bonnevilles had was backing up the three impressions, one of them being Curtis Mayfield. At one of the gigs in the South, this little tiny juke joint that they were playing in, Jimmy borrowed Curtis Mayfield's amp and was playing during the Bonneville set. When Curtis Mayfield wasn't looking, Jimmy cranked the amp up quite loud and blew out the speakers and didn't own up to it. And Curtis was looking around trying to find the guilty party. And he never found out that Jimmy, till later, found out that Jimmy blew up his amp.
Jimi Hendrix played on and off many times with this group called the Curtis Knight Band. Here's How Would You Feel? Stephen Robey is my guest, co-author of Becoming Jimi Hendrix. So there are two guitars in there, Stephen. The first, that fuzz tone guitar that sounds like it's foreshadowing Jimi Hendrix's Crosstown Traffic. And then that second guitar kind of copying a guitar lick from Like a Rolling Stone. Which one is Hendrix?
It's all Hendrix. In fact, Jimmy's doing the background vocals. That's a weird mix. I've never heard that one. The guitar is really low or echoed into it. It's quite strange. But that comes from 1965. Jimmy had met Curtis Knight, an aspiring guitar player, singer. And Curtis hooked him up almost immediately after their meeting with this session to record How Would You Feel, which is one of the first black rock protest songs. And shortly thereafter, Jimmy unfortunately signed a contract with that record producer for $1, a 3-year binding contract that came to bite him.
The lyrics of that Curtis Knight song also reflect the real experience of musicians like Jimi Hendrix who were touring in the South. What are some of the problems he had to deal with?
Oh, racism, basically. Jimmy really had never experienced that before living in Seattle and a different racial culture there than in the Deep South. In fact, in Becoming Jimi Hendrix, we talk about one of the times that Jimmy and his bass player, Billy Cox, were arrested in 1962. There was regular racial protest going on, especially at the lunch counters in Nashville, Tennessee. And Jimmy and his bass player, Billy Cox, got fed up one Sunday afternoon, decided to sit in the whites-only section, and were arrested immediately. And thankfully, the club owner that they were playing at bailed them out the next day, but he made them pay the fine, too.
It's kind of a fascinating portrait of the early Jimi Hendrix. You write of his naivete, his immaturity. He was, of course, mad for the guitar, yet for many years he kept having to pawn his guitars. A lot of groups he played in, the only reason he had a guitar is because the band leader would get it out of hock for him. And you also reveal that beneath Jimmy's kind of spacey, gentle surface that attracted a lot of people, there was also a great deal of anger, and it often came out against women.
Yeah, Jimmy and alcohol never mixed, and when the two of them got together, things got quite violent. There's a scene we talk about in the book of a girlfriend he had at the time, who her nickname was Big Sandy, and Jimmy had been drinking, and Jimmy warned Big Sandy not to touch his guitar, and she kept fooling around, fiddling around with the strings and everything like that, and it got to a point where he grabbed her by the neck and took her into the bathroom and started choking her. And as we explain in the book there, that several of Jimmy's friends and co-musicians at the time had to grab him and pry his hands from her neck loose. And Jimmy thankfully regained his senses. But he and Big Sandy were no longer boyfriend and girlfriend after that.
I know a lot of the tension in Becoming Jimi Hendrix is Jimmy exploring these new ways of playing the guitar, these new styles, this new volume, and kind of running up against the R&B standards and the people he was working with, who oftentimes didn't understand what he was doing and didn't really want to embrace it at all. And one of the first recordings where you start to hear Jimi Hendrix's style come to the forefront is this recording. It's with saxophonist Lonnie Youngblood. It's called Wipe the Sweat, Part 1. Now that starts to sound like the Jimi Hendrix we came to know much more. As you write it, Stephen Robey, Hendrix really came into his own when he kind of got off the circuit, began playing regularly in New York, and particularly when he was playing down in Greenwich Village. What happened there that freed up his style?
Well, the simple answer is LSD. He had met a girl, her name was Linda Keith, who was the girlfriend of, at the time, Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. It's the summer of 1966. Jimmy is playing with the Curtis Knight Band at a place called the Cheetah Club. And boy, what an amazing place that it was. Linda almost fell in love immediately with Jimi Hendrix. Keith was out on the road touring with the Rolling Stones. Jimmy needed a guitar, of course, and she lent him Keith Richards' white Fender Stratocaster. Jimmy got a gig at the Cafe Wa in Greenwich Village in New York City and started playing that. There's a funny scene in the book where we talk about Keith Richards finally returning from his tour of the Rolling Stones and hooking up with Linda Keith and finding out his white favorite white Fender guitar, Stratocaster, is being used by an African-American gentleman playing at the Cafe Wa. And so Keith Richards grabbed a gun and started and headed down to Greenwich Village to get his guitar back and see who this guy was that was playing his guitar.
There's just a lot of great stories in this book, Becoming Jimi Hendrix, that Steve Robey wrote. You wrote with your co-author, Brad Schreiber. You talked to dozens and dozens of people. But even after all that, and even after writing this book, are there still aspects of Jimi Hendrix's early career that you weren't able to track down or things that still puzzle you about him?
Well, there are still recordings that I'm still looking after that actually I know where they are. It's just a matter of getting to the studio and getting them freed up. Some of the recordings he did with the Bonnevilles, a group that I mentioned from 1963, there's about four demos that Jimi recorded, which would actually make it the earliest known Jimi Hendrix recordings out there. And they're sitting in a warehouse in Nashville, Tennessee, waiting to be released. And those are some of the things with along with some other tapes. There's a commercial that Jimmy did with Joey D and the Starlighters, a one-minute commercial that this small club in Massachusetts did for this nightclub. And Jimmy's playing the peppermint twist and feeding back at the same time. So that's still out there,
too. Well, that's to look forward to. Hey, Stephen Robey, yeah. Thanks for speaking to us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Robey, the co-author of the book called Becoming Jimi Hendrix. David Hyde produces the program with Jenny Osarno. Andrew Walsh produced today's program with help from Rachel Solomon. Andy Hurst is our engineer. Special thanks to Legacy Recordings for providing us with a sampler of a new Hendrix box set called West Coast Seattle Boy. I'm Ross Reynolds. Here's the rest of that cut from Jimi Hendrix wailing with Lonnie Youngblood on Wipe the Sweat, Part 1.